Welcome to Plans Are Booked, a podcast for every reader. I'm Molly Geller.
I'm Stephanie Blackburn.
And I'm Caitlin Madison. Welcome. We're here on a very rainy afternoon, and what better way to chat books and spend the day than eating Steph's cookies and making her make me a London fog? Because why wouldn't I? I feel like have a fair trade though, because I did bring over sushi molds in various different animal character shapes. I bought like a 12 pack and stuff, and I agreed to split them. And she said, "What do I owe you for these?" And I said, "All the London fogs." So that's our trade. I think that I made out like a bandit in the trade. It's been a minute since we've been together because I had a sinus infection. So we moved when we were recording that this is how dedicated we are. The team was like, "Caitlin, we'll change days. Don't worry about it." And now I'm fully medicated on antibiotics. Spoiler alert to the Republicans, medicine works. And I'm feeling a lot better. Sassy, you know, the whole thing. Thursdays are my day off. I slept for 11 hours, woke up, made myself eggs. I don't even know if I did anything, and went back to sleep. And just that was the day that things really turned around for me. So I'm feeling a lot better. My week was pretty much going to bed at like 8:30 at night so that I could go to work, because my students just had a lot going on this week, and like being absent was not really an option. And so I just like powered through it. And that's not my only job. I also was at my brother's office. That is less tedious. As long as the phone's not ringing off the hook, it's like pretty manageable with like a head cold. But the getting out of bed was really bad. And like, you know, the raw nose, I was like a faucet for like 5 days straight. It was just, that was my week. I don't really have anything exciting to report because, oh, I had some really good pho. My brother and I went to the pho place that I took you guys. And I just put all of the sriracha and all of the chili crisp in it. And Brad was like, "Have a field day. Blow your nose 87 times. Who cares?" And it was delightful because I had tried to be good and have a salad one of the days. And I felt like I was just eating leaves. I felt like I paid $20 for leaves. It was depressing. So the pho was a win. Really, that's... Oh, the other thing that I guess that I would report is I've been listening to a lot of 80s music because I guess people don't maybe know that I'm like really into music and that I go to like a lot of concerts, but I do. I listen to a lot of music. I'm on an 80s kick because I watched One Day, and before that we saw All of Us Strangers. And so I have both of those playlists saved on my Spotify. And I gotta tell you, it is a raucous good time. I'm just in the car bopping around to 80s hits. It's probably screwing up my day list algorithm. It's fine. But that's it. 80s music, One Day, sinus infection, pho. That's it. That's all I got.
The reason that I baked cookies last night is my anxiety was at a...
And made a quiche today, no less.
You know, I anxiety bake. That's what I do. This week I was installing drywall. It was frustrating. Then I did 2 days.
Very heavy. You're underselling this. Heavy, heavy stuff.
Steph's doing
she's
like
not just installing. It's like she's the laborer and the installer.
I was going to say, this is extreme manual labor.
My aunt is in the process. I've been helping her for the past year going through. She's going to knock down, rebuild her house, has been going back and forth with the architect on the drawings, and then she would send them to me, and I'd be like, "We need to change this, this, and this." And she recently came to me and was like, "Is it true that drywall is 60 pounds?" And I was like, "Yeah, that feels about right." And time-lapse videos make it look like it's just a piece of cardboard that you're holding up in the air, but that is not the truth. And then backer board, which is the thing that goes behind tile in the bathrooms, is a cement board. So that's probably, I don't know, three times heavier. It's It's heavy. It's awkward. In order to cut it, you have to use a special type of saw because you're cutting through cement and dust gets everywhere. I've had to wash my hair every single day and I feel like Kelly Kapowski, but like it's a whole thing if I have to wash my hair. It's like an evening for me. So the bathrooms have not managed to have all of the backboard installed, although I did try my very best to get it done because the flooring starts on the first floor on Monday, which means we cannot be in the house for the entire week while they are gluing and installing the hardwoods. So it was sort of like a race to get this done. And then in a week, my father goes on a golf vacation to Florida for a week, and I will be all alone manning the ship. So.
Okay. I want to say, though, we mentioned this last week, and for those who are following us on Instagram, hopefully you saw some of Steph's amazing video content that she does while she's at the house. But this week, you started doing these epic voiceovers of the videos that I am obsessed with, and now I just want you to do it every single time. And I know it's more work, and the timing is really intricate and hard, but they're freaking amazing.
I think because I get so many like one-off questions from people that I realize I'm not like explaining things as I go. And while I would prefer to just stick a song over a time-lapse video, I think it makes more sense going forward for me to be able to explain things to people.
And it should be on TikTok.
I'm.
Yep. Mm-hmm. No, that's. I can tell you the hashtags. It should be. You will get so many hits. DIY. House building. I'm not going to name all of them, but I know what they should be, and it would be hits galore.
I don't have the mental fortitude, strength, time to also handle a TikTok.
Okay, but when the house goes up for sale and you're procrastinating on editing your book, that could be a nice little.
Yeah. Anyhow, that's me.
Since we last saw each other, I went to Miami and came back. I went for 4 days to visit my family. My sister and brother-in-law are planning on moving out of Florida, and they took a little trip to like investigate their potential new area. So I flew down to help with the kids. I hit the jackpot on the weather, like full sun, 75, 80 degrees every single day. My niece and nephew are freaking hilarious. And even though I slept very little and I slept on a couch, it was a great time. And it's so fun to be with them. And because I FaceTime with them so much, there's no like reacquainting of who I am, which is very nice. And I hadn't been there since Thanksgiving when I had to leave like in a rush because Scout, my dog, was sick. So it was nice to have just like a chill time. And as I always do on every trip, I went to Books and Books, which is my favorite independent bookstore in Miami. I told myself I wasn't going to buy anything. I bought several things. And also,
why even walk in the door if you're like, that's just a tease.
Just like the browsing, like being near the books. I don't know.
Sniffing them.
Yeah, kind of. It's like how I feel about Diet Coke now. Like I can't drink it, but I can be near it. But I have to say, my mom was with me and we went into the kids section first. My cousin Tamar has a new baby and my mom wanted to buy some books to help build the baby's kind of first library. So I was helping with that. And then I found a children's book called Fearless, all about Taylor Swift. I took a picture of it immediately and I was like, Caitlin needs to see this. I'm sure that there are other children's books about Taylor Swift that just happened to be the first one that I've ever seen. So I felt like I was having a celebrity sighting out in the wild. I've
definitely never seen a children's book about Taylor Swift.
I have.
Oh.
No surprise. Okay.
It's a, what are those books called from when we were kids? A little golden charm book, a golden.
Oh yeah. Those ones with the gold spines.
With the gold spines. Yeah. They made like a spoof of one of those and it's about Taylor Swift. A little golden book. Is that what they're called? I'm going to look it up. Sorry for the tapping.
No, that's okay. Type away. So anyway, big shout out to Books and Books, who is not only an amazing bookstore in Miami, but hosts this incredible book fair every year. We mentioned that book fair when we talked about the romance authors event. Beverly Jenkins, the queen of sass, was talking about being at that event and all of the authors that she met, including one that sort of scoffed at her being in the romance genre. And she simply said, I have 60 books published. How about you? So anyway, Books and Books is incredible. And if you find your way to South Florida, they have multiple locations and they're in the airport. So even if you don't have time to go to the store, you can shop in the airport.
That is a brilliant marketing idea.
It's very good. So Little Golden Books, they have an entire Famous Faces series that they've done to resurrect the childhood gem that it is.
I love that.
Taylor, Beatles, Bee Gees, Beyonce, Bruce Springsteen, Oprah, Betty White, Dolly Parton, Harry Belafonte, Frida Kahlo, and on and on and on. So they're back in biz. Little Golden Books have made a comeback.
I feel like I need to make a new cubby in my bookshelf for kids' books like that.
There's also that series called Who Is? It's like, who is Albert Einstein? Who is Michael Jordan? While I was at Books and Books, I saw the one that's called Who Is Aretha Franklin? And it took an incredible amount of restraint not to purchase it.
So many moons ago, my students had to do a character project on a courageous character. And I had this kid... I will never forget this. I had this kid who I hope that one day he finds this podcast. His name is Alessandro, and he is like blue-eyed, blonde hair. He's probably 20 by now. And he came up to me and he was like, there's somebody on the courageous characters list that I would like to do. There's somebody that isn't on the list that I would like to do. And you said, if we had a good one, we could pitch it to you. And I said, absolutely. And he goes, Aretha Franklin deadpan. And I was like, 100% yes. I don't know why she's courageous yet, but I'm guessing she is, and like, run with it. And he's like, he did like a fist pump, and then he ran back to his desk group and was like, she said I could do Aretha. And I was like, it was hilarious.
That's incredible.
That being said, I wouldn't let them use those books as a source.
I had to do like better research than that, but I was like, if you want that as a starting point, it's probably better than Wikipedia. So I let them use it for like biographical information only.
That's absolutely amazing. Yeah, it was very fun. I feel like if I am in a kid's section of a bookstore, I usually am going for a specific thing. Like I know I'm getting something for someone's baby shower or first birthday or whatever, but it was cool in this moment with my mom to just be like, okay, if we had like a totally blank slate, what would we add? And then I started noticing all of this other like celeb stuff, which was very fun. So I know we're three of us in bookstores all the time, but that was like an especially good, almost like mental refresh of looking at stuff I hadn't noticed before.
And how where did they go? Durham,
North Carolina.
Did they like it?
They loved it.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. So my brother-in-law, James, he's probably not going to listen to this, but that's his name. James went to Duke and loved Durham then. And Emma used to visit him there quite often. She went to school in Savannah, so like not too far a drive. And I don't think they had been back since he graduated, to be honest with you. So they stayed in a neighborhood kind of close to the campus, and they did everything one could do in 3 days. They went out to breakfast. They went to a farmer's market. They went to an art museum. They met up with friends for dinner. They just really loved it. And they were very pleasantly surprised how comfortable they felt there. And I think it's still in the South. And part of the reason that they're moving out of Florida is because the political environment is so awful. And they were looking for somewhere a little bit calmer, and they weren't quite sure how it was going to feel while they were there, but they were really pleasantly surprised. So now they're like actively looking for a rental apartment, and they're going to like move forward.
Wow. Well, I guess that's great for them and a win for you because it's closer to here. But maybe your parents maybe will be a little sad or follow them or rent something that's there so that they can go there whenever they want.
I will say I looked at flights from Boston to Raleigh-Durham, and the cost as compared to Boston to Miami is like, it's a whole different world. The flights to Miami are exorbitant, like 6 months out of the year. And these flights, I tested a million different dates, and like the most expensive combo I got to was $250.
Bananas. That's really great. That'll be really nice.
And in a surprise to no one, I have begun following restaurants in Durham on Instagram. I've never been there before, but when I get there, I will only be eating at excellent places.
She comes prepared, people. If anybody ever needs a restaurant recommendation, Molly is a great person to, like, we don't even care. Message us at Plans Are Booked. It doesn't matter. Just be like, I'm looking for restaurant Molly and what her food itineraries are in such and such a city, and she will hook you up. I mean, Vegas to Tel Aviv to DC, whatever you need. Molly's previous blog life, she documented a lot of foodie locations, and I rely on it on a pretty regular basis. And even my friends who don't know Molly are like, could you ask Molly where I should eat when I go to whatever place? And I make that happen.
I am not going to lie that I have fantasized about one day maybe being like a hotel concierge. And like, especially here in Boston, I think I would be like superb at it, helping people figure out where to eat, what attractions are worth it, what to pay for, what not to pay for. Like, I've just kind of tested it all, especially here.
I think that that could be like a really fun, like, retirement thing for you to do.
Totally.
Like, 2 days a week, Molly just goes in and is like this boss concierge. That'd be pretty cool.
I always pictured myself like at the Seaport Hotel, but if there are other hotels that would like my expertise, just give a shout.
Well, that brings us to our topic today, which is a topic instead of a particular book. It's Angeline Bouley.
It's an author.
Yeah, it's Angeline Bouley. We love her. I'm going to let Steph intro this because she's, via her mom, brought this lovely author and lady into our lives.
Yeah, when we were getting ready to sit down here today, we were sort of scrambling, trying to figure out who owned the copy. And it turns out the Angeline's first book, Firekeeper's Daughter, was actually my mother's copy that got passed around to everybody back in 2021. A little backstory about the publication of that book. It was a bidding war with 12 different publishing houses, and she got a 7-figure deal. And on top of that, the Obamas won the option to make it into, I believe, a TV series, although I was looking today and I can't find anything updated. It said it was going to come out in 2023. We're now in 2024. So I'm not sure if it's stalled or
I wonder if the writer's strike maybe delayed them.
That probably could be. I hope that's the only issue and that it's still going to move forward because I have been so excited to see this. And now she has a second book out, which we all just recently read, called Warrior Girl Unearthed. I was reading up on the first book. It came to Angeline when she was 18 and was dating an undercover cop.
Did not know that.
Yeah. So the premise of Firekeeper's Daughter, which is the first book, the characters do somewhat carry over into the second book, is about, is she 19 in that book? Donis is, she is half white, half native. And it takes place up in Michigan in the Sault Ste. Marie area. And she comes from a hockey family, but she's sort of straddling the line of not quite fitting into the white, you know, realm and not quite fitting fully into the native realm and kind of trying to find her place. And in the midst of it, is it her best friend that ends up killed? And there's sort of like a discovery of underground drug dealing. And I also read that Angeline somehow made it into a state cop training on how to make meth. This was her research for the project.
So this area of Michigan apparently has like a huge meth issue, and she deals with it in terms of like the lens of young adults and teenagers and how it affects that population and like who sells it and how you get it. And there's just kind of this, they're in the woods and this is how they like to party. And this is kind of like, you can come across it pretty easily. And there's a lot of like, this is how to avoid it, but also it's a little bit unavoidable. And I think one of the other things that needs to be said about Angeline is that she was part of Obama's administration. So she was the director of, hold on, I want to get this right. Hold
it's
on.
In the back it's of Indian the book. Education within
Director
the Department
of the Office of Indian Education at the U.S. Department of Ed. So mm-hmm. She was very involved with education, and then I think she was already in her 50s when this first book came. This is her first book.
It took her 10 years to write, apparently, but she conceived of the idea when she was 18, and I think it just sort of like nested in her brain until she fully worked it out. I forgot to say right off the bat that these are technically both considered YA books. I know we mentioned before that neither of them reads like a YA novel.
The first book, Firekeeper's Daughter, Donna's, I think one of the appealing things for me was that she's really having an issue with identity. So she's really having a struggle with like, am I more white? Am I more indigenous? Where am I accepted more? Where do I feel more connected? And that kind of runs throughout the whole book. And part of her identity is like, well, you're Firekeeper's daughter. Like, this is who you are. Like, don't you feel that? And don't you honor it? And don't you, you know? And she's like, when do I feel it? When does it happen? Like, and so she's kind of, it's not until she faces some obstacles that she really like fully understands like, okay, this is where I come from. This is what I stand for. This is who I care about. So I think that that's really interesting. And I also feel like it was becoming popular right around when Reservation Dogs, the TV show, came out. And so there was just this whole push of like more Indigenous people in TV and books and media and doing it right and having it be created by Indigenous people and acted out by Indigenous people. And I think that that was just like some really interesting timing. And also her first book won The Prince, which is basically the Newbery Award for Young Adult Lit. It also won the Walter Dean Myers Award. She won a bunch of Goodreads awards for it. I think it was in Reese's YA Book Club. Like, this book made the rounds. And I don't know anybody that I've like recommended it to that has not liked it. My mom read it. We made Molly read it. Like, you and I read it. I had my brother read it. Our number one fan, Tessa, I had her read it. Like, a lot of people have read it. And this, a lot of those people are people that don't typically read YA, which I think is really interesting.
Also think that it's great that it's YA because you're learning. I learned so much from these books. And it doesn't feel like a learning experience. It's like very beautifully woven within.
Well, and I think that that goes along with the aspect of her identity, because the reader learns a lot as she's learning a lot, mm-hmm. because she's trying to decide if she's like wanting to actually be like an official member of her tribe.
I will just say that this isn't a book I would have ever picked myself.
Mm-mm.
It has a very actually eye-catching cover, I think.
Oh, it's striking.
But I don't think I would have grabbed it on that alone, either because it would have been in the YA section, where I actually saw it in a bookstore today in the YA section. And also, she was an unknown author to me. Like, there were just a lot of reasons that I wouldn't have gravitated towards it. And both of you loved it so much, and I fully trust your recommendations. And I found myself being like, I'm so glad that I did do this, because I learned a ton. And also I felt like it was like a topic that I would never have otherwise pushed into, if that makes sense. Like, not just that part of the country or the hockey part. This is pre-Beartown, people. Or the identity piece. It was just so different than anything else that I would normally read. And I was really grateful for it. I felt like it shoved me into like another kind of education and learning, and just made me think about things that I otherwise wouldn't have been able to think about. And in both of the books, she oftentimes will write in the native language. And I've talked about this, I think, on the podcast before, that some of my favorite books are written by Junot Diaz, who writes a lot of his content in Spanish. And I find that so meaningful, because it's like his native brain, and he's sharing things as the way that it feels most real and true to him. And even though I don't intrinsically understand a lot of the things that she shares, and she does put definitions of certain things, I was so glad that she pushed forward and did that, even if 99% of the people that read it do not understand upon first reading it. Like, it's real to her. And I thought that was so special.
I feel like we should say that the second book, Donna is in it, but she's no longer a main character. It's a couple years later, and it's her nieces who are the main characters.
Tell the people what it's called.
Warrior Girl Unearthed. Her nieces are twins. They are Perry and
Pauline.
Thank you. Perry is the protagonist, and there is a summer program where you have to work within, oh my God, I can't even think.
It's like the tribal council, kind of. Yes. The tribal association.
You give time to your community, essentially.
Yes. And you get, I think they got to pick, but she waited too long, hoping that she wouldn't have to do it, and got kind of dumped with this oddball slash amazing museum director type character, who is like the best sidekick, sort of like a fatherly figure, quirky. He was absolutely the right character for this, to sort of steer her through her deciding to learn about her own background and people. And I have listened to a lot of podcasts that deal with MMIWG2S, which, if you don't know what that stands for, it is, oh God,
Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women.
Women, girls, and Two-Spirit. I've been waiting for HBO or Netflix to come out with like a docuseries where they actually go into cases of missing people, and I don't know why they haven't. It makes me furious. But this one also deals with that. Another book that I recently read that also deals with that, just while we're on the topic, is Blood Sisters by Vanessa Lilly. So if you're into that topic and just sort of interested in more books that have Native words and sentences woven throughout, definitely pick those up. I wanted to read there's like a division of groups of chapters within this second book that they just struck me sort of like lightning, to the point where I realized that I am completely ignorant of artifacts. I don't know why, but when I go to museums and look at artifacts, I'm not thinking about the story of the people who lived with those items. Like in this specific sort of scenario, moccasins or woven baskets. Like, I don't think about who made them, who wore them, who lived day to day with them. I think of them as just sort of like objects that sort of exist in a glass case in a museum. And so this book just made me feel so stupid for not actually thinking about those stories and how many items have been stolen or dug up, or even bodies that have been dug up from their graves. And so there was this one section, I actually posted it on Instagram when I was reading it. This is at the sort of the beginning of the book, and it says, this is not fiction at this point. These are quotes that are meant to sort of, I think they're meant to jar you, you know.
And this all has to do with Perry's,
yes,
internship that she does with this quirky museum guy who is very into repatriation and making sure that things go back to where they're supposed to be, including the title of the book, which is Warrior Girl Unearthed. There is a warrior girl that she is aiming to get back to her proper resting place, because, as we all know, Indigenous burial grounds are like very sacred places, and a lot of people have not ended up being back where they should be and honored and having like the safe space and like the ceremony that should happen for their souls to be able to rest.
Okay, so this one says, you have significantly more deceased Native people in boxes on your campus than the number of live Native students that you allow to attend your institution. This is from Shannon O'Loughlin, chief executive of the Association on American Indian Affairs, in a letter to Lawrence S. Bacow, president of Harvard University, February 18th, 2021. That's the part that like upset me the most, is like, this is present day. This isn't like 100 years ago.
No. And I knew shockingly little about the laws around it and like the restorative practices that are like trying to happen and the arguments and fights that people are having all the time. And I sort of knew a little bit about it, but in terms of the legality of it, I didn't realize that it had been way more outlined, and like it should be an easier process for a lot of these people to get back what rightfully belongs to them. So each of those chapters that has snippets of, like, you know, either legal documentation or letters or, you know, people in big public spaces making these declarations of, like, here are the facts and, like, we still don't have what we should have, was really, I thought, compelling. And also, I really want a lot more young people to read this, because they have a lot of power and a lot of followers and a lot of whatnot, what have you, on social media. And I feel like those pages are jaw-dropping enough that, like, they would pull a 16-year-old out of their chair, right?
And cause a conversation for the classroom. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the second book would probably be a quote-unquote safer book to discuss in school, because it's not talking about drugs like the first one is. So hopefully there's teachers out there listening to this that think about, you know, if you're teaching high school, picking that book as your summer reading or something, because it would start so many important conversations.
I also think the way that she chose to write the second one, where Perry herself, who is inside the tribe and is part of all of these rituals and wants to honor her ancestors, she herself didn't know many things about how this went down and what the laws are now in the U.S. So I think as the reader, you get sort of like, you're going along with her. So even if you have that feeling of like, I can't believe I didn't know this, or like, she also didn't know it. And she's inside that culture herself, which I think makes space for people who are totally new to also be like, okay, like, I'm learning along with her. And I think it makes you feel almost like more invited into the story. And though I too felt a lot of shame around not knowing how intense and like how far scaling this situation is, I think the way she's written it, it allows you to really hear all of those things that are very true without getting so disturbed that you stop reading. Like, you're definitely shaken, but you want to keep going because you want to understand how she's going to reconcile this with inside of herself and what kind of role is she going to take going forward. And there's a moment where she kind of has an opportunity to like accelerate through the end of her time in high school, and she's thinking about, will she do that, will she not, what kind of professional career will she pursue. And she really wants to try to make things right for her own community. And I think it ends on a note where you as the reader have this sort of opening to be like, if there's anything I can do to get smarter about this or tell more people about this, I should do that so that more people fully understand what the situation is.
I also think that even though this isn't technically a series, I would recommend reading Firekeeper's Daughter first, which is the chronological order that the books came out, because Angeline Bouley spends so much time with the setting in the first book, and you really learn what it's like to live in an indigenous area of the northern United States. And I don't know a ton about Michigan, but the book takes place like right on the Canadian border, and it's very much like, this is how we get through the winter. Hunting is still part of our, you know, everyday lives. And hockey is really big there because like they have ponds. They don't have to wait for a rink time. And like, there's just a lot of like niche things that I feel like you learn that in the second book, it's almost assumed that you know a little bit about it and you know a little bit geographically about the place. And so I would read them in order just so that you can fully grasp the gravity of like what is happening 10 years, because the books are 10 years apart. So what's happening 10 years later in the same place?
What was so interesting to me is that you have to take a ferry to get from the island to like everything else. Like, I can't even imagine, one, the cost, two, the time you have to make sure you're there for the time the ferry's going to be picking you up. And if you miss it, then, well, guess you missed whatever you needed to get to on the other side. Just how inaccessible we have made transportation and movement for Native people was sort of staggering to me.
And what's interesting is they do like a safe passage ritual every single time they come or go, which I thought considering it's like a barrier between them and the rest of their broader community, they still view it as a gift, like to travel safely back and forth, even though it's this thing that isolates them and makes them less capable of access to food, access to healthcare, all those things. I did want to read one thing that I discovered at the very end of the book in the author's note, which I thought was kind of interesting. She wrote, "The story behind Warrior Girl Unearthed began in 2018 on Twitter. Someone tweeted an idea for a Lara Croft movie, quote, but she's native and returning artifacts that museums stole, end quote. It was a great movie idea, but that's all it was to me. My focus was on completing Firekeeper's Daughter and getting a literary agent for the indigenous Nancy Drew story that had been in my mind since I was 18 years old. Flash forward a year, I now had an agent and spent the summer of 2019 revising Firekeeper's Daughter. Our plan was to submit the manuscript to editors that fall. After 36 years of working on the story of my heart, I could tell there was a light at the end of the tunnel. But what next? Writing a sequel with Donis's next adventure felt more exhausting than exciting. Perhaps all I had in me was this one story. I could be satisfied with that. Then one Sunday, while on a lawn walk, a voice popped into my head. I stole everything they think I did, even some of the stuff they don't know about yet. I stopped in my tracks. Who was this defiant girl, and what else was she going to reveal? I ran into the nearest business and hurriedly asked for a pen, paper, and a Chardonnay. For the next few hours, I wrote the inner monologue of a teen girl sitting in a police station, waiting for her parents and wondering how she got herself into this mess."
Wait, can you say the number of years again?
36 years.
To any writer out there, that is a reminder to keep on writing and keep on trying until it gets made.
Want her to come on our podcast desperately. I have so many, I have such gratitude for these books, but then also like I want to ask her 1 million questions and I want to know what it was like being part of the Obama administration, and I want to know how you get into that and like what it was that she was doing during that time. And because I'm going to be totally honest, I didn't even know that that was a position within these United States. Like, I didn't know that we had somebody doing that work. And so I just want to talk to her and ask her 100 things. Well, please let us know if you read these books, because we obviously are really passionate about them and we think that you'll like them. And I do think that these books are for men, women, boys, girls, non-binary, like young, old, whatever. I think that if you maybe had like a kid that was in fourth or fifth grade, I think if you read it to them, they could handle it. I honestly do. I don't think it's anything that they don't hear on the news. And I just feel like it's a part of American history that we don't really know a lot about, and that it should be more present. And I think that this is a really good kind of segue into learning more about it in like a, family friendly is the wrong phrase, but like in an approachable way. It's, I mean, a lot of people are like, oh, I don't want to read nonfiction, and this isn't nonfiction, but it's historically accurate fiction. So I would recommend it to basically everyone. Should we talk about what we're reading right now?
So at the event a couple weeks ago, someone brought up Allie Hazelwood had a new book out called Bride. And I was in Target the other day, and they had it 20% off. So I put it in my cart, and then I read it in two sittings. I have not read a vampire werewolf book, I believe, since the Twilight series, which was, I don't know, 16 years ago? Is that how long ago Twilight came out?
I used to read those books when I was taking the bus to my advertising agency job, which was 2011 to 2014. So sometime around then.
Okay, so this is an adult romance book, or adult fantasy? Is this romanticy? Yes.
I think it's romanticy. Let's say
yes. The protagonist, her name is Misery, and she is a vampire, and humans, vampires, and werewolves all know about each other, but they live in very different areas. Couldn't quite tell what city this was supposed to take place in, but They have this sort of system where in order to not have any fights break out, higher ranking members of the government have to basically exchange a person from their cabinet, or not cabinet, but like, so basically she was sent when she was a child to go live with the humans as like, if anything happens to her, then we get to kill your exchange, like an exchange student, except not a student, a child. So she's never really had agency over her life. And she became friends with a human, and the human has gone missing. She's a journalist. Her best friend is a journalist. And so when a marriage of convenience is proposed between her and the alpha of the werewolf group, and she finds out his name, which are the initials that were left in her missing best friend's notepad, she's like, yes, I will marry him, because she wants to figure out where the heck her missing best friend is. So she marries him and has to go live in the werewolf territory. And there's some saucy stuff, which was a little bit weird because she's got pointy ears and he's a werewolf. So
Caitlin just tried to speak and could not.
I asked
the banter. Wait, time out. The banter was phenomenal.
I mean, you read it in two sittings. Before the podcast started recording, I said to Steph, am I going to like it? Because sometimes she says, like, this one's not for you. Like, it's too many fairies or whatever it happens to be. And,
ACOTAR.
Right. I tried. I really tried, because everybody on the internet just peed their pants about that series. And she said, yes, I think you will. So I am going to give it a whirl. I, too, have not read a vampire or anything of this. I mean, the closest I've gotten is Fourth Wing with the dragons to anything that even resembles that. But I will segue into what I'm reading, because it's also bizarre is the word I would use. So I'm reading a book that I found out about on TikTok called The Will of the Many, and it's book one of the Hierarchy series.
Can you just tell the people how many pages
it's are? Like 640 around that. On the back, hold on, I want to get this right, because I had never heard this term before. Fans of doorstop epic fantasy will not be disappointed. So these books, when they're like over 500 pages, are called doorstop epic fantasy.
I hate that. Who uses a book as a doorstop?
I don't know, but it's the size and the weight, I guess.
That upsets me. That's like a rude use of paper.
I think, well, that's the nickname. I don't know what to tell you. Anyway, so it's book one. This author is another late in life author. He had one other book series that I have not read. How do I describe this book? The beginning of it really reminds me of Six of Crows, in terms of like, there's an orphan and he's like a trickster and he's out on his own in the world, like doing his thing. And he's got a secret that he doesn't want other people to know. And I'm like, okay, this is feeling very Leigh Bardugo, Six of Crows kind of thing. But his secret is that he's a prince and his parents were killed by people that I don't know who they are, but his parents are killed. And so he's basically like out for vengeance, and he's like undercover in the like day-to-day world living in an orphanage.
People not looking for him?
His whole family, he goes to a place that's not where he's from.
Oh, okay.
And this is like, it's fantasy, and so it's one of those things where like some things feel futuristic and other things, like at one point he's in like a hovercraft type of thing, and it's basically an airplane, but he's like in total awe of it. And so I'm kind of like, do they not have airplanes? Like, it's like there's aspects of it that feel very medieval. And the way that this society works is, and this is where the will of the many comes in, it's people's will. They have figured out a way to seed people's will. So depending on the hierarchy of like what class you are in the society, you get to benefit from other people's will. And so if you are lower class, you, in order to make money, sometimes have to give your will to upper class people. And people have been able to figure out different ways of managing this will. And so when they do go in this like hovercraft airplane blimp type thing is the way that they describe it, it is being fueled by the will of the many. And so there's like a, I think there's about to be a dark academia aspect to it because he's going to this academy. I'm like 100 pages in. He's going to this academy where he is to spy on the head of the school because the head of the school was like the top of his class. And he basically could have been like a big time politician. And he chose to be the head of this school instead, which is a very odd choice. And so the government is assuming that there is some great, what's the word I'm looking for? Rune of sorts on the campus of the school that he is trying to figure out how to harness and use. And so this orphan kid who actually was a prince at one point in time is now being tasked with figure out why this guy chose to be like the headmaster of a school as opposed to like any other job within the society.
I can't tell from this if you're enjoying it or not.
Okay, so I'm a really fast reader. This book, not only is it like 650 pages, but the font is like size 9 or 10. Like, oh, it is dense. Like, it is, and it is so detailed. Like, the world that this guy is building, like, is jaw-drop. Like, the ideas, like, just the ideas alone, I'm sitting there and I'm like, this is so wild. Like, that somebody's brain invented this, you know what I mean? And like, if I think too hard about like Hogwarts and Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings, like there are a lot of people in this world that have the ability to build worlds, and this guy is one of them. And I'm very interested in what happens now that the main character is like about to be at the school. But before I found out what his like mission was going to be, it was intense because it was very much establishing like, this is the order of things. This is where this guy kind of lands in the world. This is how the society works. And that was like a laborious first 50 pages or so. And now that I know like where we're going with it and what he's going to be doing, I'm very interested. But it took a little bit for that to happen.
Not even really sure how to follow that up. I'm not reading a doorstop fantasy novel. I just finished a few days ago a love song for Ricky Wilde by Tia Williams. Steph talked about this earlier, so I won't get too much into it. And also, we're hoping to do a Tia Williams episode coming up. But I will say, and I've said this before, I was obsessed with her previous book, 7 Days in June. So I was really, really eager to read this. It's very different kind of story. It almost felt not like a different author, but just the experience was so different, like emotionally. And I guess I'll just leave it at that for now, because hopefully we're going to do a deeper like compare and contrast. But then I moved right on to this book called Sex, Lies, and Sensibility, which was recommended by Allie Hazelwood when we were at this romance author event. And we all had our phones open typing stuff into Goodreads so we wouldn't forget. And I happened to see it when I was in the bookstore in Miami, and I was like, okay, it's paperback. I'm going to get this. I am about 175 pages in. It is the story of two sisters who are from Maryland who, upon their dad's passing, discover that he has just kept a lot of secrets about another family, about his financial situation. And the only way they can access any part of their inheritance is if they move up to Maine and take over a rundown inn that he had purchased and basically let go into foreclosure. So in the part of Maine that they're in, there is actually a Native American tribe, back to today's topic. And in a surprise to no one, she begins to fall in love with one of the members of the tribe who is helping them like get to know the local area and help them get introduced to, you know, everyone from contractors to accountants to whatever. It's very interesting because for those who have not been to the state of Maine, it is an extremely white place. And the main characters in this book, Nora, the woman, is black. And then this guy, who everyone calls Bear, is Native American. So they're talking about that experience of living in a super white, super rural place and what it's like to be both Native and also an outsider. The banter is excellent to the point where, like, if I wasn't going to pass this book on to you guys, I probably would have, like, written hearts on things and highlighted things. And, like, there are just certain lines where I'm like, oh my God, how does that come from someone's brain?
I would expect nothing less from Allie Hazelwood, who is, like, the queen of banter.
The fact that she, like, endorsed this so heavily in front of an audience full of other romance readers, I'm like, this has got to be great. But also, I was nervous. I was like, oh God, like, don't go into it with too high expectations. But I'm really, really, really enjoying it. And Steph and I were talking about yesterday, it's meant to be like a modern day take on Sense and Sensibility, which I'm mortified to tell all of you I've never read.
Me neither.
Oh, okay. So I might have to.
I think I'm going to force you guys to do like a classics episode. And by classics, I mean we're going to do a Jane Austen episode.
Please don't.
I've read a lot of the classics. Great Expectations is my favorite book for many, 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 many years.
Oh, we should talk about Pip.
Great Expectations is a great book. That's why, I mean, I'm happy to talk about that one.
Wait, time out. Are you saying that Jane Austen does not have great books?
I don't know. Oh. Because I think I started one time and was like, meh.
So her other book, Nikki Payne is this author. Sorry, Sex, Lies, and Sensibility by Nikki Payne. Her other book is called Pride and Protest.
Oh, I know.
Which is also a play on Pride and Prejudice. So if you like those OGs, I think you will really, really like these. And I am loving this without having read the inspiration material. But I sent a stuff that maybe I will watch the movie of Sense and Sensibility in order to get a sense, pun intended, of what it was inspired by. So anyway, that's my romance hole this week.
I don't know when I'll be done with this book. I really have to concentrate, which I know sounds so absurd, but when you are reading lighter books that are like more, like if I'm reading a book and the majority of it is dialogue, that goes a lot. The pages just fly by. Whereas like I can read 4 pages of this book and it's like a very detailed description of like what a contraption looks like in this society, or like, you know, there's a lot of like inner monologue of, because this guy is basically undercover. And so like he's going back and forth of like, do I play it like this? Do I play it like that? Did he tell that I like blanched when he said this? And, you know, he has to do a lot of like code switching and masking of like, I mean, he gets caught up at one point because he flinches when somebody says like a swear word in a language that he shouldn't know. Because like his upbringing was like he was like had all these tutors and he knows all these languages and like he's supposed to be this like orphan kid. And so there's a lot of like that sort of stuff, and it just is way more time consuming than books that I've been reading recently.
No one says you have to race through it. You can take your time.
I know, but I have homework for the pod that's other books that aren't this. And I know that you guys probably aren't going to read this one. Steph, maybe. Marissa, your sister, definitely should.
She is so busy with K-dramas that she doesn't come out of her room anymore. So I don't think she's going to read that.
But Six of Crows was one of her favorites.
True. But they canceled that Netflix show.
They did.
Yeah.
They did. Well, that was Shadow and Bone, though. I digress.
No, anyway. They were going to do a Six of Crows spinoff.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That's too bad. That would have been good. Probably too expensive. These worlds, I'm telling you, these worlds are so intricate. Fans get mad if it's not accurate, but they don't have the budget for it.
ACOTAR was supposed to be on Hulu, I believe, and it's been dropped, probably because of how much it would cost to sort of build that world up. So I'm not sure if another network is going to pick it up.
Do you think that we live in a world where we will start to see more crowdfunding for beloved things?
First, I want to say for people who aren't as deep into the book world as we are, that stands for A Court of Thorn and Roses. If you're like, what's an ACOTAR? It's an acronym for this series that is crazy popular. If you saw the book covers, I'm sure you would recognize it because they're everywhere. It's in Target. It's in all the bookstores.
It's like 4,000 words total, the whole series. And I've read the first 4 books.
I could see that the way that people can do, whether it's like GoFundMe or Kickstarter for products that this could become something that happens in the future. If fans really feel strongly enough, I don't know what the budget would be to make something like that. I'm guessing like it could be $100 million.
Yeah.
But I think they could try.
Well, think of The Crown. Wasn't that the highest budget that Netflix had ever had?
And
that
was
$100 million.
And the sets on that were so elaborate.
Yeah. I just think for a book series to be devoured in a way like that, that it would be silly not to make it. But I do understand needing to make it correctly with the with the money
and
the budget.
It's kind of like what we were talking about with Fourth Wing, how if they go cheaply on the dragons, it's just going to wreck it.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah.
Well,
as somebody that just watched a recently created BBC version of A Midsummer Night's Dream that was not very good, and my students at one point screamed and rolled around on the floor because they in the wedding scene they had Titania and oh my gosh, the Queen of the Amazons, what's her name? Not Helena. Oh my god, this is terrible. They had two of the women end up with each other at the wedding. And then they had one of the guys from Snout from Pyramus and Thisbe, they had him end up with like a guard from the wedding. So there were like all these like gay couples all of a sudden. And I was like, this, and the kids are like, oh my god, this isn't in the play. Do you think Shakespeare meant this? And I was like, I thought it was the BBC and it was gonna just be a regular version. And it wasn't. So cool. But yeah, it was, the fairies were not done well and the kids made fun of it. And so like, yeah, budget matters and all that jazz.
Well, if you guys want to see what a doorstop fantasy novel looks like, I'm going to take a video of this book and post it on Instagram. So give us a follow at Plans Are Booked over on Instagram. And if you want to make a suggestion of a book we should read or a book we should talk about, please shoot us a note to plansarebooked@gmail.com. We love to hear from you.
Until next time, our plans are booked.